Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line for you now at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with our call, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, we'll talk about hearing and dementia, a link. What does it mean for you if your hearing is going? What's going to happen to your mind?
Mm-hmm.
And dynamite, really important research about the Mediterranean diet. Incredibly exciting to share. I think this is a watershed study.
Okay, that's great. Coming up later, what's our recipe?
Taco tuna patties. I've been a like tuna. Tuna's my sort of go-to lunch food, and this is a great variation on the old tuna fish sandwich.
Mm-hmm. Coming up, again, our number is 800-462-7413. And to the phones we go, Zorba. We welcome a listener now in Franklin, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom, Dr. Pastor.
What's up?
The literature police will probably correct me, but I think it was H.G. Wells who wrote War of the Worlds.
Yes, it was.
And in that book, the invading Martians eventually die because of pathogens on Earth to which they had not been exposed on Mars, and thus they built up no immunities. While certainly not to that extreme, I've wondered if our, this is my opinion, the overuse of hand sanitizers, bottled water, and even organic foods isn't helping to create a generation not only lacking immunities to common pathogens, but also creating stronger strains of those pathogens as they build up their own resistance to the sanitizers meant to destroy them.
Interesting question. Do you use those things?
I don't.
Mm-hmm. Because you're concerned about this.
Well, my daughter uses them to excess on my grandchildren.
Right. Well, first of all, there are some issues with that. So let's first of all talk about your daughter and her grandchildren. I mean, there's a theory that one of the reasons that we have more asthma, allergies, and autoimmune diseases in America today per capita than we've ever had before is because we have these antibody systems that our bodies really are developed from an evolutionary point of view. Pathogen comes into your body, virus, bacteria. Our body shoves out some antibodies and fixes it. And if we're too sanitized, then our body will tend to reject itself. And so one theory is that children who are brought up in an environment which is made as sterile as you can possibly be have more asthma and allergies, and that tends to be the case. And there was some very interesting research that came out a number of years ago that looked at children who were raised on farms. Not many kids are raised on farms these days because only 1% of the society farms. But they looked at kids who were raised on farms, and they have an extraordinarily low amount of asthma, allergies, and autoimmune diseases as they grow up. So I think over-sanitization of children is a bad idea.
Now, how about adults?
Now, here we go with the adults. You're right about the over-sanitization about adults. Now, if we look at washing our hands when we're touching things, because I'm a doctor in the office, well, I have to wash my hands between patients. That makes sense.
Sure.
And I use a hand sanitizer more than that because it turns out it actually is highly effective. I don't have to get my hands in water each and every time. It's easier. It's quicker. And there's no proof that it's going to be worse than soap and water. That makes sense. But if I'm not touching, you know, a number of people every day, it doesn't make sense that you should keep on doing that, and I agree with you. I think we may be setting ourselves up for antibiotic resistance. Now that I've given my tirade, what do you tell your daughter when she uses the hand sanitizer on her kids?
Well, I try to stay away from it, although fortunately my grandson eats a lot of mulch.
Eats a lot of mulch. How old is your grandson?
He just turned 5.
Oh, well, you see, and mulch is organic. It's very good. You can eat a lot of mulch. You know, I've got the answer. You know, she hand sanitizes everything that's in there. But do they ever leave the grandchildren with you? Of course, right?
Well, unfortunately, I live in Cincinnati, so I don't get to see them very often.
But when you go to Cincinnati, take them out and make sure that you go to a park and let them play in dirt. And then you'll give them another side of life.
And bring a spoon to feed them some also.
There you go. There you go. But you're right. Yeah, you're right. There's a certain amount of cleanliness that actually is very useful. And when you're sick and when you're ill, there's a certain amount of cleanliness that's useful. And then you can be over the top. Just like kind of everything, there's moderation in this also. But thanks for bringing it up.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. At 800-462-7413.
The hand sanitizers have really, proliferated over the last few years. And you can just see how people bring them, and they use them all the time. And it's okay. Wash your hands before you eat food. Very important. Obviously, wash your hands between patients or use that. But, if you're going out and doing normal stuff and you don't have your hands in your mouth, you don't have to be that OCD.
You had the flu. I'm assuming still do a little bit.
Yeah.
We got together a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. I went home after we were together. I told my wife, Zorba has the flu. Mm-hmm. Oh, did he touch you? Did he touch you? And I said, I don't think so. Well, he passed papers back and forth. I said, no, I don't think. I think I just had my own. So she got out the hand sanitizer.
And immediately, that is funny. She said, you better put it on because I don't want to get it.
Yeah. Well, she didn't want me to get it.
You know,
either,
Tom, right? every week we're here week after week, but I wouldn't call our relationship intimate. So I don't think we shared bodily fluids. And so she doesn't have to worry.
But hand to hand, I could have.
Oh, come on. We never shake
hands. You were endangering me. You have to admit that.
Hey, we fist bump. That's what we do. We fist bump.
800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba, in Gifford, Washington. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I'm hoping that you can help me with my eyesight, mm-hmm. and specifically about pinhole glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of pinhole glasses?
Oh, I have. I have. When my eyes started to change back in the day, I did a lot of research on this, and I did mm-hmm. research on the exercises, and I'm blocking on the name right now of the exercises, and there was a and I'll put it on our website, zorbapastor.org, okay. And I went to an optometrist in town who specialized in these eye exercises, and she had actually been trained in this.
Mm-hmm.
And they do work to a certain extent because you're able to change the lens of your eyes. When you squint and you decrease the light that's going into the eye and you change the lens, we've got something in the middle of our eye called a lens. It's between the aqueous and the vitreous humor, uh-huh. and it's right by the iris. And it bulges and changes when you can actually alter this lens. But as we get older, the lens becomes stiffer. It becomes yellow. That's a cataract and doesn't work as well. And so I did the eye exercises. And frankly, I think I didn't need reading glasses probably for 6 months to a year. And then it stopped working.
Just, but are these pinhole glasses things that you wear?
Well, pinhole glasses are a way of not using a lens. And there's a – if you were a kid, did you ever make – you probably didn't. Well, maybe you did. Did you ever make a pinhole camera when you were a kid?
I don't think so.
No. Did you, listener, make a pinhole camera?
Yes, I did. And also, I'm an artist, and there's that technique of making a small frame with your fingers, as you look at a composition.
Right.
And it does a kind of a similar thing, I think.
That is exactly what it is. And you're an artist, so you understand that completely. It's just like a pinhole camera. And we'll put, for people who don't know what a pinhole camera looks like, we're going to put a pinhole camera on our website.
Let me ask my question again. Are these regular glasses that you wear that have pinholes in them? Or?
Well, I've heard of them. I've never actually seen them, but these are...
I actually ordered a pair of pinhole glasses.
Where'd you find them?
I was online, mm-hmm. and this op-ed came up mm-hmm. for pinhole glasses, which I had never heard of, and they're relatively inexpensive. Mm-hmm. They look like sunglasses, except that the lens, instead mm-hmm. of a dark lens, there's this array of tiny pinholes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea is to focus on the retina just like the pinhole camera. When you, a camera that has a very small hole, mm-hmm. everything is in focus, but the depth of field is narrow within there. Otherwise, we would be using pinhole glasses instead of lenses to use it. You have to let us know. I've never met anyone who's actually ordered them. I have heard of them. You are avant-garde. You are ahead of the curve when it comes to this. But I don't know if it'll work. But glasses are but it's a different way, like a pinhole camera, of delivering that. Let me ask a question. Why were you interested in this?
I mean, I read a lot,
uh-huh.
and I want to have another 20 years of reading.
Well, first of all, you will. People who read don't go blind quicker, and like my mother said, don't sit too close to the television set, we'll go blind.
Yeah.
Well, if that's the case, I would have been blind when I was like 16. But getting back to the issue, when you read, I just want to talk a bit about this. What you read in the nighttime and daytime when you're in bed, when do you read?
I start a book and in the evening, and I want to finish it, and I'll read till 3 in the morning and finish
it. You may have the wrong glasses when you're in bed. You've got the.
Okay.
I'm going to venture to say that it's more likely than not that you have the wrong glasses for bed.
Okay.
Good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Enjoy your next novel.
We appreciate the call.
Let us know what happens to the pinhole.
Yeah,
to the pinhole lenses.
From eyes to ears, Zorba, you say there's some research on maybe a connection between hearing loss and incident dementia.
Well, there is a connection. There is a connection. That doesn't mean one causes the other. But first of all, dementia, broad thing, gets worse as we get older. Women are more prone than men, not just probably because they age, but they're just more prone. We don't know why. And half of all dementia is Alzheimer's, and the other half is generally vascular disease, small strokes, small vessel disease, little parts of our brains dying and not working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's it generally. But a number of studies have shown that people who lose their hearing tend to have a higher incidence of dementia. And then the question is, there's never been a cause and effect, is the hearing loss causing the dementia or is the hearing loss from the dementia?
Yeah. Well, I know nothing about science and medicine, but it sort of makes common sense that if one starts to lose hearing, one's world tends to kind of collapse on oneself and makes it difficult for one to be, you know, connected to the rest of the world. And I would think that that might be a causal factor.
Well, I think, first of all, you are exactly right about that issue, that that if you're hearing, what happens is you withdraw from life, you don't engage in life, you don't engage in activities because you can't hear. And that's where a lot of, quote, dementia may come from. The brain is a muscle. Use it or lose it. It's not a. It's a muscle that gets stronger with doing more work and more thought and more interaction, more social interaction. So I really think that's part of what we see here. The other question, though, that I think is very relevant is: people who have hearing loss, should we look at them and start to do psychometric testing to see if they have the beginning of dementia? In other words, dementia's first sign may be a lack of hearing because you're not appreciating and responding to the sounds.
The cause and effect could be the other way.
It may be two things. It may be that when you have a hearing loss, you do need hearing aids. I have no doubt about that. I agree with you. I think hearing aids are great. The expensive ones are really good. And yes, they are difficult to get to use for many people, but they can do it. Yeah. They're not as good as glasses. We're not at that point. On the other hand, it may be that this is a sign and people who have hearing loss should be tested. I don't have the answer to that.
Can I do a little rant here?
Yes, please.
Millions, literally millions of people in this country who have hearing loss can't afford hearing aids
at all. I agree with that. I agree with that completely. You know, here it is. We spend tens of thousands of dollars on chemotherapy with someone with terminal cancer so that they will live for 6 months longer.
Yeah.
You know, insurance covers that. But yet we don't spend enough on durable appliances such as hearing aids. And the reality is that should be part of a benefits package that we have with standard insurance in Medicare. And it's not. It just has not ever become part of that.
Back to the phones. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba.
What's up?
I was interested in finding out some more information about the electronic cigarettes that have kind of stormed onto the market. From what I understand, you're essentially inhaling steam loaded with nicotine. Do you have any health concerns for these products?
Oh, I definitely do. And I want to give you a story.
Speaking of rants, I think
speaking
we're about
of
to
rants.
Hear
All right.
That is funny. Well, first of all, I write a medical column. And so I did one on electronic cigarettes. Actually, I did one on quitting smoking. And it was about nicotine gum and the fact that, you know, people who take nicotine gum tend to become habituated with it. And I said, the real sharks in the room, that's not the exact word that I used. I used another word that was equivalent to shark, are the e-cigarettes who are trying to sell you that they're safe. Well, you cannot believe the number of negative emails I got. I thought somebody was going to come into the house and start shooting in the window, throwing bricks at me and starting to take me down. Then I realized that, among other things, a number of the rants came from the e-cigarette lobby. So let's look at what they have. First of all, they have flavorings in them that tend to attract young people, just like menthol tends to attract a younger smoker and anything sweet. So they have flavorings that are sweet. Second of all, they're not regulated by the FDA. So a number of them don't tell you what's in them, and a number of them have nicotine. We know nicotine is highly addictive. There is zero doubt about that. It is a highly addictive substance. So a lot of them say, hey, you can get rid of your cigarette habit by doing this, and then they're giving you an addictive substance to smoke. And then the third thing is they have partially – they still use – when you look at the gases that are produced in e-cigarettes, they're partially combustible gases, which means that they still can increase carbon monoxide in your body. And the one of the issues is whether or not carbon monoxide is the final common denominator for an increased risk of heart attacks and strokes. So they're not necessarily safer at all. And that's my e-cigarette rant. Are you a smoker?
Trying to quit.
Trying to quit. So,
I've been using these. Switched on to the e-cigarettes about 3 months ago, and I've been smoking. I'm pretty mildly for about the past 3 years.
What's mildly?
Like one pack a month.
Well, that's pretty small. That's pretty small.
And I've had pretty good luck with these things.
You mean so you?
The one I have doesn't use the little liquid capsules that you mostly see. Mine's more of just has a chamber and a small heating element that heats it up, not to the point of combustion. You know, just to where you're getting that steam off the actual tobacco, not the little capsules that they sell.
Yeah. So what do you put in your e-cigarette?
Tobacco.
So you put tobacco in. So in some way, it's putting steam over tobacco. So just to give you an idea, and I think this is really important, I don't know when I'm sitting here what's going into your lungs and then what happens over a 20 to 40-year period. Remember, we didn't understand that cigarettes caused lung cancer until 1964. And yet when you look at Mr. Duke, who invented the way of making modern cigarettes. Cigarettes came into use when Duke Tobacco and Duke University, that's where his money went to, invented the modern cigarette machine. Before that, it was sort of cigars. So when people were able to inhale, when movies came on the front and you saw movie stars using cigarettes and they started hitting it, it wasn't for 40 years that we figured out that people who smoked for 40 years and 20 years and so on got lung cancer. We don't know what the long-term effects are. That's the bottom line issue. So you may use it to cut down. It may be useful. It may be more healthy than smoking, but I don't think you can label it as, quote, healthy. And so I think what you want to do is develop a game plan where I'm going to find a time, I'm going to figure out what to do, and I'm only going to breathe that great Washington air.
Yeah. Go from that to gum, maybe?
Yeah,
to the
the gum or anything else, whatever works. You live in a beautiful part of the world. That's what you want to
enjoy.
That's true.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
Take care.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a quick question from Mike in Appleton, Wisconsin, who's a bit far from home. I'll let him explain. He writes, "Hello, Dr. Zorba. Every year I spend 3 months in Mexico and do a lot of heavy-duty biking while I'm here. There are a lot of unsanitary things that get ground up into dust that I breathe while riding on the dirt roads. I try to nose breathe as much as possible, but the high oxygen demand makes that difficult. Are there health issues involved with inhaling in this dust? I stream your show online, so I'll be listening."
Ah, sounds great. You know, dust is always a health issue. But, I mean, if you're doing this as an avocation and a hobby and you're not working with dust all the time, I think the health issue is so minimal. And basically, the real issue is you're doing something you like. You're out there. You're exercising. And I think that outweighs the dust. I mean, I go and do things in dusty environments when I'm in the Southwest, and I enjoy it. But I think if I worked every day in the dust, obviously that would be an issue.
Well, he does a lot of biking, he says.
A lot of biking. But does a lot of biking mean that you're biking 24/7? I think dust is an issue. And I think trying to reduce the amount of dust and particulate matter in your lungs is an issue. I think if you have asthma, if you have heart disease, if you've got some risk factors, then yes, wearing some kind of a mask that will help keep out the dust is going to be better for your lungs.
Okay. Have a dilemma that's gathering dust? Don't wait. Send your question along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
It's coming up on Recipe Time. Lots more of your calls, too. Some more medical research to talk about. And, of course, our medical myth buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. We have callers waiting, but a line open for you at 800-462-7413. But now, Zorba, it's recipe time, and this time we have a lot of work to do. Marcia in Lancaster, Wisconsin, recently sent us an email challenging us to invent a recipe of our own. She has rules, though. I'll let her explain. She writes, "Greetings from Lancaster. My doctor recently told me that I should get more serious about whole grains. I told him I eat tons of fruits and veggies and fancy breads." He repeated, "whole grains." Sure enough, I dug through my cupboards and didn't find much, so I tried granola, but that had too much fat. Then I tried oatmeal, but that was flavorless and bland. Then it hit me, I should treat the whole grains like a filler, like with meatballs or meatloaf. It's great on the pocketbook, and no one knows it's there. So, Zorba and Tom, I would like to challenge you to create a recipe, but there are rules. Whole grains have to be in the food, not sprinkled on top as a second thought. It must be low in sugar, salt, and fat, and it has to make me want to eat it again and again. We listeners trust your taste. So, Zorba, were you up to that challenge?
Of course, of course. Food challenges are always great. And we've got a dynamite recipe that meets that food challenge. And it's interesting, pocketbook. Who has a pocketbook anymore? You know, easy on the pocketbook. You know, I think of that. I mean, I know what it is, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's an interesting phrase. Do you ever use the word pocketbook anymore?
No, I don't. And I don't, when it was used, why was it a pocketbook?
That's right. That's what I mean. Why was it a pocketbook?
It wasn't a book.
No, no. When in fact, it was a wallet that women carried in their purse where they had the change in there or something like that. I was just thinking about these words. I don't know if my kids would know the word pocketbook, and they'd say, is that like a book you put in your pocket and read?
Yeah.
Is that like a pre-Kindle or something like that? Now that we've gotten through the words,
right. We
have a recipe, taco tuna patties.
Okay.
Now, do you eat a lot of tuna fish?
So I have some.
Did you eat tuna fish as a kid a lot?
Some,
or not? Your mother didn't have tuna fish a lot.
Not really. No.
I like tuna. I still have tuna. I probably have tuna sandwich once a week.
I kind of like tuna too.
You know,
I need some seasoning.
Yeah, I need seasoning. I like a lot of stuff. When I get tuna, I often will get it at, you know, at a place called Subway because it's right next to my office, easy to get, inexpensive.
Yeah.
I'm always looking at that. So tuna, though, is very commonly used fish. When I buy tuna, I always make sure it's an environmentally safe package when I buy it. I always look at the package.
Yep.
And so let's talk about taco tuna patties.
Yep.
My mother didn't know the word taco.
I don't think she even understood that.
Of course she
not.
Probably said taco. Is that somewhere in Spain or something like that? I don't think she understood the word. Patty, she would understand.
Yep.
Okay, start out with 1/3 cup of non-instant whole oats.
Mm-hmm. 1/3 cup of whole non-instant oats.
Yeah, that's right. You can buy it at your local organic food store or something like that.
Yeah.
A can of tuna in water drained, 6-ounce can.
A can of tuna in water drained.
That's right. Environmentally correct tuna, mm-hmm. which I think is really important. Nonstick cooking spray.
Clove of garlic.
1/2 cup of chopped red onions.
1/2 cup chopped red onions.
1/2 large potato. I would use a Yukon King. I think they taste the best. Mm-hmm. Boil it with the skin on. Has to still be warm. If you don't feel like boiling it, you can put it in the microwave. But you're going to use 1/2 large potato.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Half of a large potato.
That's right. I think boiling is better. Tablespoon of lime juice. Fresh will taste best here. So in other words, get a lime, take it and juice it, tablespoon.
Yeah, big tea, lime juice.
Big tablespoon of taco seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
which one do you use when it's taco seasoning?
Good one.
It's a joke because you're not going to tell us which one you use. Taco seasoning
is great.
If
I knew there was any more than one kind, I would tell you.
That's right. Yeah. Very important about taco seasoning. If you're going to buy it in a grocery store, buy small containers versus large containers
because
it's fresher.
Yeah.
And I happen to like Penzi's. They're a great spice shop from Wisconsin. Yes, I am promoing it. And no, I don't own stock in it because it's a family-owned company. And my last name is Pastor, not Penzi. But they have a great taco seasoning mix.
Right.
2 egg whites.
2 egg whites.
2 tablespoonfuls of fresh cilantro chopped.
do big tea, fresh cilantro chopped?
If you dislike cilantro, you could use parsley. There are people who don't like the taste of cilantro.
Cilantro's good.
Yeah, I like it. Half can of green chilies. You know those little green chilies that you find in the Mexican section?
Half a can of green chilies.
Salt and pepper.
Got it.
So put the oats in a food processor. Pulverize it gently into a very coarse flour. In other words, you don't want it to be a fine flour, but you're going to pulse it. Then spray a frying pan with a nonstick spray. Saute garlic and onion. If you wanted to, you could put a tablespoonful of extra virgin olive oil in there, which will add some other nice taste to it. Mash together the tuna and the boiled potatoes. You're going to mash it with that boiled potato. Add the oat flour and taco seasoning, and then add the sauteed onion and garlic. Add cilantro, chilies, lime juice, salt, and pepper. Mix it well. Then, okay, so you've got this all together. Now you're going to lightly whip the egg white in a separate bowl and fold them into the batter and then form four patties. Mm-hmm. You know, so the egg white's going to hold it together. Refrigerate it so the patties firm up. Very important. Otherwise, they're going to fall apart, hold their shape. You got to refrigerate it 15 to 20 minutes, but you can actually do this in the morning and then eat it in the evening. There'd be no problem. And then spray a large frying pan, lightly fry the patties on both sides until they're warm inside, put it in the taco, and voila. Mm-hmm. You've got a wonderful dish. And if you want a low-fat taco, do not buy the crunchy tacos. Buy the tacos in the plastic pan. You warm them in a nonstick skillet and roll it in, and it's wonderful.
That meets her challenge. The whole grain is in the patties.
Absolutely. The whole grain is in the patties. We met her challenge. I think it's wonderful. 148 calories per patty. It is a low-fat recipe, and more importantly, it's a low-calorie recipe.
To get a copy of today's recipe, visit our website
at zorbapastor.org. You can look at that recipe. You can look through our archives for our other fine recipes. You can download our podcast. You can have a wonderful time looking at Tom's face and my face. Go to zorbapastor.org, and don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Lafayette, Indiana. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Okay, when I drink alcohol, my face gets really flushed, my nose and ears. And a few weeks ago I Googled and came up with there is actually a condition called either Asian or alcohol flush. And they also suggested possibly taking Pepcid 30 to 60 minutes before I would have a glass of wine. But the thing that caught my eye was that they said that there could be a higher risk of esophageal cancer. And so that's what I wanted to ask Dr. Zorba about.
This happens with just one glass of wine?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So that makes going out with friends a little difficult for you.
Well, it does. It's embarrassing because people say, oh, look, you know, look how red your face is.
First of all, you know, any association with esophageal cancer I think is so absolutely minimal, I would not be concerned. It's not something that I would be concerned about. We have no screening test, by the way, for esophageal cancer, and I've not heard of that. Now, the alcohol flush turns out is really common. And the way you treat it often, many people are treated by taking a combination of an over-the-counter antihistamine, Zyrtec, Allegra, or Claritin, generic, taking one of those, which will block one of the histamine receptors. And the other histamine receptors that are also in the body are blocked by Zantac and the old drug cimetidine, which was Tagamet. And quite often, a combination of those two will work and make a big difference.
Take Pepcid plus one of these?
Mm-hmm. I would take them both. I would see what works. So I would sit at home and do an experiment on myself. And I would have a nice glass of wine one night, and I would take Pepcid 30 minutes before and see if it works. And if it works, you're home free. The next night, I would take a glass of wine, and I would have an over-the-counter antihistamine. I'd probably choose Zyrtec because it's a little stronger. The next night, I'd make a nice Mediterranean dinner. I have a glass of wine, and I would take the Pepcid and the Zyrtec to see if it matters. If that fails, sometimes I would add an aspirin tablet to it. This is one of the old allergists told me this. One of the old allergists says that works. And then there's a drug called Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R, that you can add to the regime that will also do it. And, you know, we may laugh and say, well, you know, big deal, you have a red face when you're with friends. But the fact is, I've had patients who have said to me, look, I want to just have one drink. I want to be able to have some alcohol because other people are having it. And when I don't have a drink, people look at me because they wonder if I'm an alcoholic. It's very interesting, you know, what society defaults to. Oh, you're not having a drink. You must have an alcohol problem, which, of course,
we have to defend ourselves while we don't drink alcohol.
I'm not having to drink. I'm not really an alcoholic, even though you may think I'm one. Well, you can't obviously do that, but that's exactly it. So I would seriously experiment Pepcid, one of the several antihistamines, combination of both. And if not, I would add Muconilist, which is singular to it.
Okay. And the aspirin tablet, is that regular aspirin, not Bayer?
It's 325 milligrams. Yeah.
125.
One Bayer aspirin like my mother would have in the house.
Yeah. Okay.
Every day.
Thank
okay.
you so much.
You're
I
welcome. Good luck.
Try.
Good luck.
Uh-huh.
Good luck on drinking.
Yeah. We appreciate the call. She shouldn't like try all of this in one sitting, right?
No, you've got to do it at separate sittings. You've got to do it at separate sittings. Thank you for pointing that out, Tom. Appreciate it.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Wichita, Kansas. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I really do need your help. I'm having a terrible problem with snoring at night. It happens when I'm laying on my back. If I sleep on my back, I snore very badly. I'm getting real used to my wife waking me up. She's real sweet. She's very tolerant, but she consistently has to ask me to sleep on my side, and that seems to help. I talked to a friend of mine who's a medical doctor, and he said he knew about a process called a partial uvulectomy. And I wanted to find out more about that and see if you had any recommendations on that type of solution.
Oh, sure. So first of all, a bit about snoring. Have you been checked for sleep apnea to see if you have sleep apnea?
Well, yeah, I did a test that you do at home, and I wore a device all night.
Mm-hmm.
And in the information, they said, yes, indeed, you have sleep apnea.
Uh-huh. When it was positive, did they recommend you did the whole polysomnography test where you stay in a hospital or an outpatient clinic overnight? Did they recommend that?
Uh-huh.
What did they say about the sleep apnea that was possibly there? What was their recommendation?
They recommended a CPAP, I think you call it, machine.
Well, I'll give you, before we go into what the surgery is, I'll give you my recommendation, which is not to get the machine, but to do the right test. The screening test doesn't answer the question. It only gives you, it's like a pap test. We do a pap test on a woman. If it's abnormal, then we do a biopsy of the cervix to see if she has cervical cancer. That's the way we detect it. We do a colonoscopy, and if you find a polyp, you take it out, look at it under the microscope. The screening test that you took at home doesn't answer the question. Now, it's very important that you make sure you see a sleep specialist and they do the test. Otherwise, the insurance company may not cover it. And I used to have issues years ago with that. And now I send everyone with an abnormal test to a sleep specialist because they know how to get it through the insurance company. You need that because sleep apnea causes heart attacks and strokes. So that's number one. So that's my first recommendation is get that test. Now, the uvulectomy where they take and they remove the soft palate in the back of the mouth, does it work? It's not a very good surgery. So number one, I don't recommend you have the surgery because I don't think it's very effective. But number two, you may have sleep apnea and you need to have the real study to see. And then you have to decide if you want to use the CPAP machine. Now, those machines where you have this thing that goes over your face, some people like them, some people do not. I've never seen statistics on how many people stay with them, but I bet it's only 50%. Mm-hmm. But if half the people stay with them, you should be given that opportunity if you have it.
It sounds like, though, Doctor, that the CPAP is pretty much the only real treatment for sleep apnea.
Well, what's your height? What's your weight?
I'm 6 feet tall. I weigh 207 pounds now. I've lost. I was 220, and I noticed since I lost a little bit of weight, my problem has gotten better.
Right, and that actually is a treatment for sleep apnea. So let's assume, for instance, you're on a diet. You're going to get off another, we'll say, 20 pounds over the next 6 months. I'd go and have the confirmatory test done in 6 months. I definitely would do it when the weight was off, no doubt, because that might be your cure. Better than surgery.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Good.
All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. And good night to you. And good night, Gracie.
Whatever
say
good night.
What did he always say? Say good night, Gracie.
Yeah.
Good night,
good
Gracie.
Good night, Gracie. Before a quick break, Zorba, let's head to another installment of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Today's question comes to us from Hillary in Lake Mills, Wisconsin, who writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I grew up on Wisconsin's pancake flat land, but my husband's from Vermont. When we drive around those hills, I get carsick. We're about to visit for his mom's birthday, and I don't want to take Dramamine because I don't want to be asleep. It might be better for me if I drive, but not better for our marriage. I'd even thought of asking my husband to take me somewhere hillier just to practice. Is there something else I can do to ease my queasy stomach and dizzy head?
Well, there are a few things you could do. First of all, she has noticed right away that if she drives, she doesn't get car sick. So, you know, sometimes there are compromises in marriage. So that would be the first thing I would say is, hey, honey, I want to drive through the hills of Vermont. Now, that
you
may
tell your husband, Dr. Zorba says.
That's right. It may be that the imperator of the famous radio doctor will take over and actually do that. On the other hand, that may not work. But that's something that I think is worth discussing. Mm-hmm. Hey, I don't get car sick if I drive. Scopolamine patch. This is a patch you put in the back of your ear for seasickness. It also will work for car sickness. Goes in back of the patch. You can do it. There are a number of compounding pharmacies that will also give you scopolamine that you can put in the back of your ear. Some people get a little tired from that too, but that is another thing you can do. Mm-hmm. You can try over-the-counter non-drowsy antihistamines such as generic Claritin or Zyrtec or Allegra. All of those can have an effect, not quite as good as Dramamine or Meclizine, also known as Bonine, but they still may work. And those are kind of the things that I would generally recommend. And the final thing is, there's a drug called Ondansetron or Zofran, Z-O-F-R-A-N, and Zofran is used to prevent the nausea of chemotherapy. And it used to be $20 a pill, but hey, that would be worth it if you're going to go see your kids and you don't want to vomit on the way.
Yeah.
But it's now become much cheaper as a generic. And 4 to 8 milligrams of Zofran under your tongue may also work for 6 to 8 hours. I have used that with people successfully. So those are all of the treatments. But I think the conversation with the husband is the first one I would try.
Well, don't drive yourself or your spouse crazy. Just send your traveling questions along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have an interesting topic to talk over. We have some more of your calls, and we have our medical myth buster, too. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. But before we take our next call, Zorba, some really important research on a topic you've been talking about for a long, long time.
Absolutely. The Mediterranean diet. Incredibly important watershed research that I want to share with you. It's wonderful stuff. So first of all, we've known for people along the Mediterranean Sea, we've known for years that they have less heart disease and less stroke. This particular study is a major study, and to go into it, I'm going to give a little detail. Mm-hmm. 7,500 people followed over a long period of time in Spain. They had risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Many were overweight. Many were smokers. Many have had other risk factors for cardiac disease, put on 3 diets. Number 1, low fat. Mm-hmm. Number 2 and 3 were Mediterranean. The Mediterranean diet is a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, nuts, and olive oil. Okay? The 2 different Mediterranean diets, one were counseled to take 4 tablespoonfuls of olive oil every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, they could use it in their salad or in cooking or whatever, but they had to do it every day. The other group got a combination of walnuts, almonds, and hazelnuts, and they had to eat 1 ounce of the mix each day. And they would, you know, which is roughly a good sizable handful. Mm-hmm. They measured their urine to see whether or not they were actually doing this.
Wow.
In other words, they had a compliance issue. Are you really eating the olive oil? Yeah. Are you really eating the nuts? Yeah. And they had biomarkers in the urine. So we know what that is. The nuts are roughly about 1/4 cup of nuts or so. So they did that. So here's what they found. First of all, they found that hardly anyone could stick to the low-fat diet. In other words, it didn't work. And I find that very interesting because for years I've given people a low-fat diet and I said, well, stick to it. And it turned out only very few of the people could stick to the low-fat diet. They did counseling. They gave intensive counseling initially to the people on the Mediterranean diet. And then during the study, they did the same thing for the people on the low-fat diet. And here's what they found. People who are on the Mediterranean diet who are at high risk for heart attacks and strokes had a 30% reduction in heart attack, strokes, and most importantly, death, compared to the people on the, quote, low-fat diet.
30% reduction.
Huge. It is huge. That is mind-boggling. These are people at high risk. That's as good as a statin. That is good as adding another couple of blood pressure pills. That's as good as – that's better than getting on the treadmill for 30 minutes a day, 7 days a week.
Kind of amazing.
I mean, this is an absolutely watershed study, and it's a lot of people, 7,500 people. Yeah. And in fact, they broke the code early because when they looked at the divergence in the death rates, they said it's not ethical to keep the study going.
Well, you're not going to say this because you're too humble, but – if you could, you would say, I told you so.
Right.
You've been talking
right.
about this for
right.
years.
Right. That is true. That is true. I have been discussing the Mediterranean diet for years, and this is the proof that it really works. Use the Mediterranean diet. Get rid of the low fat.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, a Jacksonville, Florida listener is with us. Hi.
Hi. This is Jimmy from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah.
I exercise very regularly, and my question is, what is my target heart rate?
What is your heart rate now?
My heart rate now, probably about, my resting rate's about 78 to 80.
Uh-huh. Well, the easy way to figure out your target heart rate is 220 minus your age. First of all, that's your maximal heart rate. So your maximal heart rate goes down as you get older. Mm-hmm. So in other words, a 20-year-old is generally going to have a maximal heart rate of 200.
Maximal means what, after exercise?
If you exercise at top speed when you're 20, most men and women can get to 200. That's their heart rate. Totally top speed, gore out, I'm going to go as fast as I can on the treadmill. You take a 50-year-old and that drops another 50 points. Instead of being 200, a 50-year-old's maximal heart rate is going to drop 30 points more, so it's going to be 170. So what's your age?
I'm 70.
70. So you take 220 minus 70, and first of all, and that turns out to be your maximal heart rate. And then you take 80% of that. So it's 220. The formula is 220 minus your age. That's your maximal heart rate. And then your goal, if you're exercising aerobically, is to get to 80% of that number. And that's roughly where you should be. So what sort of exercise do you do?
Well, I work out 5 days a week.
Uh-huh. And, what do you do? Do you do aerobics when you actually work out?
I do aerobics 2 or 3 days a week, uh-huh. Do Pilates and yoga.
Uh-huh.
But I find that when I do spinning,
mm-hmm.
that according to that scenario, I'm running almost 90-some-odd percent, and I feel that I'm loafing. I'm mm-hmm. not doing anything if I'm at the 80% rate. It's uh-huh. just like hardly breaking a sweat.
Uh-huh. Well, you can push yourself. I mean, this is no magic number. In fact, frankly, when I think about it, I don't know where the 80% came to. We know that at 80% you're getting aerobic activity and you're going to get benefit. But it's not that you go to 80% and then you stop. You feel better at 90% or 95%. You can do it. Do you have any cardiac disease at all?
No.
Mm-hmm. Smoker? Were you a smoker in the past?
No. Wow. Oh, I mean, 40 years ago.
How much did you smoke? For how long?
Oh, that's very, very little.
Very little. Okay, so you don't have smoking as a major activity in your past.
No.
I think there's no risk. I mean, your maximal heart rate, in other words, you're going to get aerobic benefits at 130 for your age, 220 minus, as I said, 220 minus your age times 80% roughly is about 130. So you're going to get maximal activity, but it's going to be okay at 140, and you're not causing your heart any stress. Now, there's something very interesting. I used to smoke. I smoked when I was in college, thought it was cool. So I smoked for probably 3 or 4 years and quit many, many years ago back in the 70s. But once you smoke 100 cigarettes in your lifetime, you are immediately at a, in a higher risk category. The British medical, the Brits, who are very good at keeping track of their health, and doctors have shown that. So it's very, very interesting how even the cigarettes, and I smoke more than 100 cigarettes because I was a pack-a-day smoker for 3 or 4 years, but even 100 cigarettes increases that risk slightly. We mitigate that risk by the right weight, exercising on a regular basis. And I would say it's very important that I follow a more Mediterranean diet, which means nuts. Any nuts, of course, with plentiful fruits and vegetables will satisfy what you have. So,
do peanuts qualify?
Peanuts do not. I don't. Peanuts are not a nut. They're a legume.
Okay. All right. All right.
Take care. Good luck on your exercise.
I didn't realize peanuts did not qualify as nuts.
They are not a nut. They are a legume. So, yes. Well, that's what the show is about. So, thank you.
You're saying we're nuts?
Thank you very much.
Saying that we're nuts. Our show is nuts.
Thanks for calling. 800-462-7413. And Zorba time once again now for our medical myth buster. Today we have one from Jack in Knoxville, Tennessee, who needs you to clear up some radiation rumors. He writes, "Hey, Dr. Zorba and Tom, I just started a new job, and now I'll be flying a lot. I've heard that airplanes receive a lot of radiation because of how high up in the atmosphere they fly. Am I in danger?"
Well, first of all, they do receive more radiation because they fly up.
Mm-hmm.
They fly. And this is a very interesting issue for pilots because the question is whether or not they get more melanoma, among other things, because they're in the front of the plane. There's light coming through, you know, obviously through the windows in the airplane, and whether or not the extra radiation increases leukemia risk and lymphoma risk. And there have been some studies that seem to show, yes, there's a radiation load that's that is affected by that. The younger you get the radiation, the more likely it's going to cause a problem. But living at Denver, for instance, which is the Mile High City, gives you more radiation because there's less atmosphere and that does it. Mm-hmm. So are you at risk? But yes, it is so minimal that I think I would pay more attention to driving safely in wet weather than I would be worried about flying on the airplanes.
Yeah. Is the answer to your myth still up in the air? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. A listener in Port Wing, Wisconsin now. Hi.
Hello. How are you today?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, so you're talking about Vicks VapoRub and the question of how much science there is behind whether it helps or is it just that warm, fuzzy feeling of mom taking care of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it sparked my interest about something I've been doing with my children who are now 4 and 7, and my big child, my husband at 53. And, when they have a runny nose, a kind of cough, and for the kids, I've been doing it since they were infants. I give them a nice warm bath, and then immediately when they come out, I take some Vicks VapoRub, or we use a all natural product using the same essential oils, and I put it on their feet,
mm-hmm.
and then I immediately put socks
mm-hmm.
on.
Uh-huh.
And put them to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great.
Kind of as a bedtime routine. And I'm just wondering, mm-hmm. is there any science behind it, or is it that warm, fuzzy feeling of mom taking care of you?
Do you do that ritual with your husband as well?
I do sometimes. He'll ask me to, and now the older kids will ask also.
So you put Vicks VapoRub on his socks and put him to bed, tuck him in. I think it sounds great, actually. I don't find anything wrong. You know,
no.
Sometimes I say, who cares about science? You know, what's much more important is getting tucked into bed at night when you're not feeling very good at all. So let's look at science, but let's also look at medicine.
Yeah.
They call it the art of medicine because it's not just science. There's also art involved, too, meaning what do you apply to different people in different circumstances. And I'm a great believer in the self-healing of the body, certainly when it comes to infection. We know, for instance, that people who meditate get less colds, less sore throats. They have a more robust response to the influenza vaccine. That's what Richie Davidson's study showed at the University of Wisconsin years ago. So we know there's clearly a mental aspect to illness, no doubt about it. And if Vicks VapoRub or the equivalent thereof on your feet makes it feel better, then that may instigate something going on in your mind, which is clearly connected to your body, that helps you fight the disease. So is there science behind it? No. But is mom behind it? You betcha. So keep it up.
Okay, great.
And you know what?
Thank you.
You know what? Next time I have a cold, I'm just getting over a cold right now, but next time I have a cold, I'm going to ask my wife to rub Vicks VapoRub on my feet. And I happen to sleep with socks.
Put you in a warm tub. And then
put me in a warm tub, write Vicks VapoRub on me, wipe, you know, put on a towel, get me nice and dry when I get out of the tub, comb my hair, the bit of hair that
and
I have
let
left,
us know how that all turns out.
I will, Tom.
Yeah.
I will. And I'll post it on Facebook.
Okay.
I'll post it on Facebook, too. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah. Before we head out for the day, Zorba, let's take a quick question from our Facebook friend, Gary, in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Gary is suffering from a bit of diet dilemma and writes, "Hi, Zorba and Tom. First off, I love your show, but neither of you looks anything like what I pictured. My question is, how is it that just an ounce of high-calorie food can add pounds to my waistline?"
Well, I don't think an ounce can add pounds to your waistline. You know, it depends. Even an ounce, let's see, an ounce of, there's 100 calories in one tablespoonful of butter. So if you have 2 tablespoons of butter, you will have 200 calories. And
right.
200 calories actually will add to your weight. If you have 200 extra calories a day, you'll have 2 to 4 pounds at the end of the year.
How can 2 ounces add?
So in other words, it depends on the calories. An ounce here and an ounce there in the end does add to your waistline because we are incredibly efficient organisms and you eat another couple of hundred calories, and the answer is you are going to gain weight. So the answer is how? Why is it? Mother Nature. Go ask her. You put it on the envelope. Mother Nature, drop it in the box. Maybe you'll get a response. Even do it on email. Maybe you'll get a response in email. I don't know. Maybe Mother Nature has a Facebook page.
If not, pretty soon. Have a conundrum that's weighing you down? Just send your medical mystery along to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And you can, of course, call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. The show is produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0316Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.